on this episode of Rebel Spirit Radio.
Death illumines life. Death and life are not separate.
Right.
You know? And Nick, we can go a little further if you like. And so these are topics that are very close to my heart. Mm. And, you know, Socrates himself talks about we don't know.
Right.
That we don't know. And Whitman talks about it. Whitman has long sections on death. And it is, nobody knows that it isn't a good thing, yeah. You know. So if you focus in on this part of dying and the part that that trusts, that accepts, that believes that our consciousness endures, because consciousness is deathless, you know.
Right.
This whole thing is going to continue on without, even if we are not here with this body, you know. Yeah. And so that is what we need to focus on if we are afraid of dying.
Welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio, exploring the frontiers of spirituality, consciousness, the esoteric, and humanity's sacred relationship with a living earth.
I'm your host, Nick Mather, and in this episode, I am joined by award-winning playwright, poet, and author Kamala Kapoor to discuss her latest book, The Privilege of Aging, Savoring the Fullness of Life. Kamala shares her insights and experiences on aging, emphasizing the importance of self-reflection, the challenges and rewards of self-love, the necessity of exploring aging and death head-on, and the value of spirituality and embracing the mysteries of life. Also, please be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. Your support is truly appreciated. Kamala Kapoor was born and raised in India and studied in the United States. An award-winning playwright, poet, and author, her writing has been featured in anthologies and journals such as Parabola and The Sun. A former literature professor at Grossmont College, she and her husband divide their time between the remote Indian Himalayas in San Diego, California. She joins me today to discuss her latest book, The Privilege of Aging, Savoring the Fullness of Life. Kamala, welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio.
Well, thank you for having me, Nick.
Yes. Well, I'm looking forward to speaking with you. As I mentioned before we hit record, your book's a different book than most of the books that I speak with people about. And I think everything will be fine on my end. It makes me a little anxious, I suppose. But I did very much enjoy the book. I thought it was beautifully written, and it's very, very personal, I think, out of necessity. And I thought that a good place to start is sort of why you wrote the book. And I think you state it in the very first sentence of the first chapter, where you wrote, "I don't want to wait for old age and death. Rather," and this is outside of the quote, "but rather you wanted to encounter them and meet them head on."
Yes, that is one of the reasons. There are always many reasons why you write a book, you know. As a writer, I'm compelled to write. That's how I live. That's how I breathe. And I especially write about those topics that are sort of bothering me a little bit. And because writing is a way of plugging into the topic and of exploring it. And so I wanted to explore aging, and I wanted to explore, of course, one never knows about death, but I still wanted to concentrate my consciousness around death, because that's what old age heralds most, and it is what causes the anxiety around aging for most people, because even if when they don't articulate it to themselves, they know, they subconsciously and subliminally know that old age means, okay, this is the end of the line, and we are moving closer to the event horizon. Right. And that was another reason. And then, of course, as you get older, you kind of want to re- capitulate your life a little bit and what brought you to this point in your history. So that was another reason. And the third reason, and there are many reasons, but I'll just mention one more, is I wanted to find a book that spoke about aging and a character's experience of life in a very honest and raw way. So I ended up, because I couldn't find that book, I ended up writing it myself. And so I've peeled back many layers in this book and discuss them and show them. And that's a brief history of began.
Yeah. No, I definitely see that in the book. It's a very courageous book, I think, in the sense that, you know, especially in Western culture, we do not like to think about death or growing old, and we sort of hold up youth as this, you know, grand thing. And you took this very honest look, and I was thinking towards the end of the book, there's, you're talking about going on a hike and, you know, the knees and are hurting you, and but, you know, you're pushing forward as best as you can. And all of us have to face this. And it's a act of self-reflection, I think, that I think we all have to engage in. It's never an ending thing.
It never ends. It never ends. And I think that unless you self-reflect and self-reflect as honestly as you can, I think our lives end up being a little purposeless, you know, because we want to live deeply. We want to live intensely. We want to dig our suckers into life, you know, the way butterflies and hummingbirds do. And in order to do that, we have to self-examine and self-reflect. I think that that is something that's essential, and it's something I do in my journals practically every morning, because it gives me a very good idea of where I am that day. And it allows me to express, you know, all my concerns, and then it allows me to see them, and then it allows me to transcend them, because that is the journey. I mean, the purpose of self-reflection also is self-transcendence.
A couple of things come to mind. One, obviously, I think is Socrates, the unexamined life is not worth living.
Yes.
And the other is one of my favorite writers and thinkers is Henry David Thoreau. And in Walden, he mentions, you know, sucking the marrow out of the bone of life.
Yes. Yes. And you know, many gurus, my guru, Guru Nanak, talks about people who don't self-reflect as animals, because, you know, that's what Socrates says, not worth living. And I know it from my own, and I'm not judging others. I'm judging myself, because I have days and moments where I'm not living as deeply as I could. And I am just eating and sleeping and, you know, not really thinking much of anything. And those days are fine too, but you can't live a life that way. You know, you have to live more deeply. It's a rare gift to be alive. And so self-reflection becomes very necessary for our happiness, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that. And there's also an aspect of, as we move through life, there are a series of transformations. And as you get older and you retire, you kind of abandon, you know, you used to be a teacher. And I'm familiar with Grossmont College, by the way.
Oh, great.
Yeah, I spent 20 years unfortunately, as a adjunct professor. I used to be at Pasadena City College and East Los Angeles College. And I think there was some training at Grossmont that I have participated in, but that's besides the book.
I was an adjunct for a long time before I got a teaching position.
But there is this transformation of, you know, what do I do now through these changes?
Very important. That's something I've struggled with a lot. And I don't mean just the larger picture, what do I do now? Because I always have that larger picture, I write. But there are days I have had recently many, many periods where I haven't wanted to write. And so the question arose, what do you want to do then? And sometimes the answer is nothing, you
Right.
know.
Yeah.
So, and how do you do nothing? And I have had to expend a great deal of energy on doing nothing productively. No, because generally we think about doing nothing and you think about, oh, you're lazy, you're unproductive, you are not participating, this whole culture is based on doing, doing, doing. My husband and I call it doo-doo, you know. And so I've developed some techniques to navigate my this phase of not wanting to do. First of all, you have to redefine doing and not doing. You know, when you say you're doing nothing, if you're doing nothing unconsciously, then you're in trouble. But if you do nothing consciously as an active, dynamic choice, then you are learning how to do nothing. When I began to do nothing, I would time myself for 10 minutes. I'm just going to lie here and breathe, or not even breathe, just look out that window, you know, and counted those 10 minutes as the most productive time of my day. There are many ways of doing nothing, and I'm planning to write a book about it, you know, because I think this is the most difficult issue for people who are aging. What do you do with your time? And there seems to be so much of it. And I would seriously advise people who are thrashing about, like I was thrashing about for a long time, about what to do with my time is, I think meditation is one of the greatest ways of doing nothing, because you're meditating, you're just sitting, but it's a conscious choice. You sit and then you let your mind go where it goes and gently kind of pull the reins to bring it on track. And after 20, 30 minutes, you wake up quite refreshed. Or even if nothing happens during your meditation, you would have sat for 20 minutes. And that itself is a great benefit to our health and our state of mind. So doing nothing is a very long chapter for me. And so if that satisfies you, I'll end it there. Or if you have another question, I'd be happy to address it.
Oh, sure. Well, a couple of things that you said, I did want it to kind of expand upon. One of the sentences I had from the book written out here was, I think it's consistent with all this, is resting is the way to live well in old age. And I see the meditation as part of that. But also, I'm curious, because the way you described this idea, you know, the do-do, that seems to be very much American, and it's part of our heritage. You know, some might say it's part of the Puritan work ethic, and we get this sense of identity involved with our jobs. I mean, that's the first thing you ask someone when you meet them. Oh, what do you do? And it seems like there's this challenge when that falls away. There's this sense of identity. And it goes back to this idea of exploring the identity and the sense of self. Now, I know I'm kind of rambling a little bit, but I wanted to ask, since you have your feet in two different cultures, that you have your feet in, you know, the United States, but also in India, do you find similar attitudes in India?
Well, you know, you are absolutely right about how we have identified ourselves with doing and our labels. You know, I'm an engineer, or I work for this huge company, and it all has to do with appearance. You know, how we appear to others. But since you raised the two cultures, I have to say that it's not just an American thing, although it's very pronounced in America. It exists everywhere. I take my mother as an example. My mother was, she kept house her whole life, and she kept it like she ran it like a captain runs a ship. And she was very much engaged with doing, and it gave her her identity. It gave her her purpose. But she also learned towards the end of her life to let go a little bit. And it has to do with, it boils down to your ego identification. What do I do when I don't have a social identification? And that becomes the question, how am I relevant in the world when I don't, when I pull back from the doing? And I think it's very important to create your own relevance as you age. And the relevance can be very simple things. I like to just go out into the garden and look at things, even when I don't want to do anything. Going for a short walk, and just lying down, taking a nap for 10 minutes, and congratulating yourself for doing that, not berating yourself, because most of this judgment is self-imposed. It's you lazy thing. Why haven't you done this today? I mean, what is your purpose in existence? It's this constant whipping of oneself to be what one was, which one can no longer tolerate or be, So that is where it has to be addressed. And in the book that I'm writing now, there's a whole chapter on this, which is about how to conquer that part of your mind that's always scolding you. And that and it can only be, I think it can only be overcome with self-love. I'm very big on self-love.
We internalize the that work ethic, and we internalize the manager or the taskmaster, however you want to phrase it, and we're constantly criticizing. But that is actually something that came out very much in the book, was this practice of self-love. And like looking at yourself in the mirror and telling yourself, oh, I'm beautiful. And things like that. And I think that's so crucial and important, especially as we get older, because we often hold, the ideals of beauty with youth. And but it's not. You are a beautiful person. I'm seeing you here. It's lovely.
Well, I have to tell you that I've been through a severe illness. I'm only just coming out of it. I probably won't come out of it for another year or two, I'm told. But I had put on a lot of weight because I was on prednisone, and I had become something I couldn't recognize. My face had swollen out. And the challenge at that point becomes loving yourself, and I persisted with that. Every time I looked in the mirror and my face looked all bloated, I said, "You are beautiful. You are lovely. I love you," and it tided me over. It tided me over. So no matter how you look, maybe you look beautiful in an accepted sort of way, or you've got all wrinkled, you're wrinkled and you're old and your eyes sag, and which happens to all of us. That's the point. And we have to love our body. We have to love our body no matter what it looks like. We here in America, it used to be every time I was in India, I was very comfortable with my body. But as soon as I came to America, I felt I'm not slim enough, or so that our bodies are vehicles. They are, they are, they're what have carried us through life to this period. They're very precious things. We only realize it when we fall sick. But loving our bodies is very, very important, especially as we age and begin to disintegrate in some ways.
You often hear, and I've experienced this myself. I remember being very, did not like my body. There was a lot of shame involved and always felt that I was overweight and things like that. But as I got older, I would look back at pictures. I'm like, wow, I was actually pretty handsome. I was in good shape. And I think there's a value to, understand that, you're beautiful now, whatever period of life you're in.
Yes, and I turned 76 recently, and I know that when I turn 80, I'm going to look back at my 76 self, self, and say, "Well, she was beautiful then." But I hope even when I'm 80, if I live to be that long, that I would consider myself beautiful and love my body till the very moment of parting. You know, because we have to part. We have to part with this body, and that parting has to be somewhere in our consciousness.
It seems to me also that, especially in American culture, I mean, we're highly critical of our bodies because our culture is constantly giving us these almost impossible images. But we also d don't focus on the body in terms of our spirituality in many ways. And it seems to me that one of the tasks is to embrace the body because we know we're going to lose the body.
Well, also to embrace our body because God lives in it, because this universal spirit, whatever you want to call it, energy, power, force, is what motivates us. It is what keeps us alive. So we have to, our bodies are just on the physical continuum of our spirituality, and to keep that in mind is very, our bodies are temples for the divine, and we forget that. We only think of ourselves as meat, which is going to perish when we die, but there's so much more to us than to even our bodies. Our bodies are a miracle. If you just look at yourself and see how much it does without our consciously making it do these things, it's a marvelous machine. It's awesome. It's the flower of creation. Instead of fearing death, we have to rejoice in not being dead yet.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. But it seems like there's a letting go involved in a lot of things, and you've mentioned that. Letting go of the fact that, our bodies are never going to be what they were when we were, 20 years old. And we have to let go of a lot of, and you do this throughout the book, you let go of a lot of things. There's like a lot of regrets, fears, things like that. So I kind of wanted to ask about this process of letting go.
Well, there are so many things to let go. Right now, the examples that come to my mind immediately is that I was diagnosed with polymyalgia rheumatica 3 or 4 months back, and I couldn't even walk. I couldn't turn over in bed, and of course. And then the normal way of thinking is, God, what's happened to me? I used to be able to do this and this and this. I used to walk. I used to do my yoga. I used to do this. If you get stuck with that, then you have no energy to move forward with what you need to move forward with. In this case, you need to let go of how you were. And we are always morphing. We are like molting is the word. We molt into something else periodically. Even us, all our cells die off every 7 days. So it's like we are new, and we have to let that which was go and tackle what is. And There are many examples of the many things that we need. You know, we have dreams that didn't get fulfilled.
Right.
And if you're going to stick with those and say, oh, boy, you know, oh boy, this didn't happen and that didn't happen, and, you know, stay stuck with that, then you're not going to have a quality life. And that's where you're going to be stuck. You know, and really, I think the bottom line for all of us is to ask ourselves the question, do we want to be happy with what we have left, you know, with what time we have left? And if the answer is yes, then you'll need to do everything that needs to be done in order to shed that part of yourself that's keeping you tethered to that which was or that which wasn't. So there's that letting go, and then there's letting go of people you lose in your life, you know, and we lose a lot. And apart from these things, the material things we lose as well. We lose our youth. We lose our bodies. Sometimes we lose money, and sometimes we lose property, and sometimes there's so much, or sometimes we lose a limb or something. And we can't, you know, the people we admire most are the people who move ahead with a certain degree of acceptance and joy.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking of as you were speaking, was this connection between loss and acceptance.
Yes. And acceptance becomes hugely important from day to day. Yeah. You know, you wake up in the morning and you're not feeling as bright as you want to feel. And instead of, like, you know, forcing yourself to do things that you think you should do, you just rest, for example. Right. Give yourself, you know, 10, 15 minutes of rest. And you've accepted that you're tired. And you wouldn't allow yourself to rest until you've accepted that you're tired.
Yeah.
You know, so it's acceptance works in our day-to-day, hour-to-hour existence, you know?
Yeah, and I think that so many of us just don't want to accept the fact that we are all getting older and that we will all die.
You see, that is understandable, because we are human. We don't want to lose life.
Right.
We don't want to lose youth, and we don't want to lose agency. But my answer to that would be that unless you accept the rest of your that where you're at right now, the rest of your life will not be a happy one. You'll be an unhappy person, because you'll always be mulling over that which you've lost. And so, you know, my meditation every morning is the second thing actually I do is I ask myself, what are the things today or right now that are happening in my life that I need to accept? And a lot of the times it's, you know, something health related. And then once I face that, then I can proceed with, okay, I can do this about it, or I can rest, or I can, you know, eat right today if my stomach is upset, you know. So what you're going to do always depends upon your acceptance of what is. That you cannot change. You have to accept, and you have to tweak your perspective on it.
It also it also seems like we have to accept uncertainty.
Uncertainty.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Alan Watts has a wonderful book called Wisdom of Uncertainty. Mm. And Alan Watts is a wonderful, you know, essentially everything in your life is uncertain when you think about it. You know, when you don't think about it, you know, you feel you're just proceeding with your life as it is, and it's just going fine. But when you start thinking about these eternal questions, I mean, one of the questions that my husband and I are asking ourselves, you're making our trust, is who's going to die first, right? And what are we going to do, and that sort of mm-hmm. thing. And even though we can write trusts, even though we can plan, things remain essentially uncertain. Mm. And so we have to live with a certain degree of uncertainty, but we also have to embrace that uncertainty, because within that uncertainty is also a lot of potential. Mm-hmm. You know, things might turn out, if you fear them, things might turn out badly, or things might turn out well, right? If if you're open to that. And if you trust the universe, I'm really big on trusting the universe.
Yeah.
The universe, hey, I trust you, don't let me down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this goes back to something you wrote at the very beginning of the book in terms of the trust in the universe, but also what we look for and our sort of, I guess, our expectations of aging, because you wrote, focus determines your reality. We find what we seek.
Yes, that's exactly right. And that ties in with trust. Mm-hmm. You know, if you feel that the universe will come through for you, and I know from past experience that it has. Mm-hmm. In 1993, I lost a previous husband to suicide, and it was very, very challenging and difficult time of my life. But when I really think about it, a lot of help came my way. Mm-hmm. And for help I did not even seek, but that was sent, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I think that the more you trust, the more the universe will provide. There is definitely a sympathetic relationship between us and the universe. I mean, we cannot deny it, you know. You might want to call it God, you want to call it a higher power, you might want to call it just the multiverse, you know. And your days are better. You spend a better day if you're trusting the universe than if you're mistrusting it.
Hmm. It also seems what's connected to that is gratitude.
Oh, gratitude is huge. Gratitude is huge. And just recently, I happened to remember something I told a little story I told my father when I was quite young. I think I was about 12, and that's when I heard the story. And it was something like, I cried because I had no shoes till I met a man who had no feet. Mm. And that really impacted me. And it's like, you know, it's unfortunate that we have to feel better by thinking of other people's misfortunes, right? You know, but this is a comparative, relative world. Mm-hmm. And we tend to do that. And it's okay to feel that you have been gifted with many things, because we don't know how to count. You know, when we're feeling low, we think, oh, I don't have this, I don't have that, I don't have this. But if you start counting all the things you have, I mean, they are infinite. Mm. From being able to walk, from being able to move your fingers, yeah, from being able to think, you know, and counting all the things that didn't happen. Some days I come home from a drive on the highways where I almost got whacked. And I say, my God, you know, that is cause for a lot of gratitude. Or even if you don't get whacked, you make it home safe. That's, you know, the more thankfulness you give to the universe, the more you realize you have.
Mm. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, since we're talking about the universe and God, about the spirituality that runs through the book, because one of the themes that comes up quite a bit is, I think you were raised in the Sikh faith, certainly Guru Nanak, the founder of the Sikh traditions. And my understanding is that Sikhism has this idea that God is beyond however it is expressed in any religion.
That is beyond any of the other ways that.
It's that no religion encompasses the true expression of God.
Oh, yes, we are just all religions are an attempt. They are an attempt to fathom God that is fathomless. I like to use the word mystery. It's a mystery that is beyond us, that when religions attempt to know, this is God, this is not God, this is what to believe, this is what not to believe, then you run into trouble, then you run into us versus them. And Sikhism in its roots is eclectic, believes we, all of us, no matter what color, gender, race, caste, class, money, that we are all one. And the Guru Nanak's definition of a religious person, somebody who sees that we are all one, that you don't discriminate against anyone. That is true religion,
Yeah,
and
my understanding is that Guru Nanak traveled extensively and explored all of these different religions of his time. I've always found it quite profound. And so I guess my main question is if you could sort of discuss the spiritual aspects of aging. And if you want to ground it in the Sikhism, that's fine. But I can also, I'll just ask it generally like that.
okay, that's a very good question, but I just want to backtrack a little bit. I've written about Guru Nanak's journeys and his whole story in a book called The Singing Guru, and that covers all these topics. But I think that the only aspect for me of aging that is of value and that tides me through and keeps me afloat is spirituality as I age. Because as other things fall away, as your life in the world out there falls away, and your body starts to send you signals of not quite being right and or of moving towards that moment where it's going to leave us, and that I know from my own life, and I have frequently experienced depression, and I talk about that in the book as well, is that the only thing that pulls me out when I am feeling really low is a turning towards the higher self that I contain and praising it, praying, loving it, loving myself as a manifestation of that energy. It's the only thing that pulls me out, honestly. And every religion has their path. There are prayers, there are rituals, and I think that no matter what religion you come from, if you can cultivate this knowledge and this certainty of something much vaster than you, that you came from and that you're going to go to, return to, that is what is going to see us through a good old age. I think spirituality and aging go hand in hand, because when you're young, you're so busy doing other things, making money, you're ambitious, you want to make a name for yourself, you want to, this, that, and the other. But as you age and you do less outside than you could do before, then it becomes very important to turn to, go to books. Books are a great way to awaken your spirituality. and go to your, you know, go to your religious texts if they give you solace. Just don't go to those texts that tell you others are worse than you.
Right.
Or that others are going to go to hell, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think I can't, and because I believe that spirituality is essential as we age, the book I'm writing another book on Guru Nanak right now, and it's called Pilgrimage to the Self.
Yes.
And Guru Nanak's map for our times, you know, because he itemizes all the things that we need to do, that techniques and tools that he gives us that help us. Like one of them is conquer your mind and conquer the world. You know, when we're feeling low, we're just swirling around in our own stew and in our own crap, you know, if you can just interrupt that with, I don't need this right now. I don't have to think like this right now. That's the way you're conquering your mind. And it works for me every time I resort to it. Well, there are times it doesn't work for me also, but it works more often than not. You know, so tools and techniques, tweaks and perception, getting out of yourself and seeing things from another perspective, you know, becomes very important for your state of mind, for your state of your body, for your overall health, and it allows you to experience life fully,
right?
No
yeah.
matter where you're at in it.
Yeah. Yeah. I had one of the phrases that I had written down here in my notes was the pilgrimage to self, in fact, because I liked that idea. And it seems to me that that was so much of what you're doing in the book. And this is self with capital S. And I know that there are traditions and even psychology. I believe Carl Jung, who you mentioned a few times in the book, thought that it was the latter parts of life that we would start focusing on spirituality. And I know in the Vedic tradition in India, I forget the specific name. I know it's got ashrama in it, but there were these stages of life. And the last few stages were focusing on spirituality.
Yes, you know, James Hillman, also, who was a Jungian psychologist, has a line, I can't quote it exactly, but he says, old age was intended. We were meant to grow old because this is what, here is when our character is truly formed. You know, it's when you're facing a lot of challenges, which we do face when as we age, and that dealing with those helps form our character. He says it's necessary for the human soul to go through old age.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see that. I can see that. It's not for the weak. Aging is not for the weak.
No, it isn't. What was that phrase? Not for sissies.
Yeah, yeah.
Not for sissies. Yes.
Yeah, I don't remember who said that, but I think this kind of talks a little bit about some of the other topics that we've talked about in this, like beauty of aging and embracing it. And it was, you talked about a Persian rug, buying a Persian rug, and your idea was, I hope it doesn't fade. And the salesperson told you, you wish it fades because there was more value in the fading.
Yes. Yes. Which is true of wine, which is true of, I mean, I'm not today what I was even 6 months ago because of all my challenges, but I think that I'm a stronger person for it. And I have to admit that it's not all a hunky-dory. You do have down moments and you do suffer and you have to experience your suffering self before you can come out of it. You have to embrace the suffering. Otherwise you're stuck with it. So if you embrace the suffering, you can get the lesson from it. And Guru Nanak calls suffering a tonic, a medicine, because when you suffer, you are made more humble. You are taught what you're doing wrong, how you can improve it. You know, if we didn't suffer, we would be insufferable. We would not be humble people. So, and you have to have compassion for your suffering self, for your suffering self, you know.
Yeah. Well, and it seems like if you develop that compassion, that connects us with others, you know, it's, yeah.
Yeah, you see that if you've suffered, you see others suffering, you know what it's like.
Yeah. Well, that's what compassion means.
Yes.
Is with suffering. And yeah. I'm curious, I know we're starting to run out of time here. I don't have too much time left with you, but I'm curious, and this is stepping a little bit outside of the text, outside of your book. What would you change in our, especially in the United States, our cultural attitudes towards death? If you could write a new script for how we address aging, what would you change?
Well, I've always felt that our education fails us because it doesn't give us a grounding in the issues of life that we all face when knowledge itself doesn't come to our rescue. And what does come to our rescue is if we have had an education, and this is an education we can give ourselves also if we are motivated enough. And I would advise everyone to do it. Like, I have a chapter in the book where I talk about Socrates' death, and I talk about reading all the books on life after death and of, you know, near-death experiences, which are written by like Moody and Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, and they give you a peep into what is possible in the mystery. Nobody can say for a fact what happens when we die, but again, we have to come back to the trust that whatever happens will be a good thing. Like Thoreau is your hero, and his last words to his sister before he died were, now comes good sailing. That gives me goosebumps, you know. Comes good sailing. And so to trust and to believe that whatever lies ahead is good. For example, in one of my readings, an older gentleman brought up this question, how do you know what happens after? And I said, I don't know anything, but it makes me happy to think that if any part of me survives, that it's going to be taken care of and it's going to be good. And I said, you know, if you want to be unhappy and believe that it's all over when you die and you're just dust, and our bodies are, you know, the consciousness that survives is ever new and never dies. If you want to be unhappy, you can believe, you know, things that make you unhappy, but it's a mystery. And people who say that we finish when we die, or people that say that we carry on in metamorphosed into something else, and that they, you know, they have a vision according to which they're approaching death.
Right.
If you don't have that vision and you're always, you know, thinking, oh, I'm getting older now, I'm going to die, and that's the end of it. But I think that accepting your death, here we come back to acceptance again. I mean, death we have to accept because it's inevitable, and we tend to forget about it. But if you accept it, then your life becomes better. Death illumines life. Death and life are not separate.
Right.
You know? And Nick, we can go a little further if you like. And so these are topics that are very close to my heart. And, you know, Socrates himself talks about we don't know.
Right.
That we don't know. And Whitman talks about it. Whitman has long sections on death. And he says nobody knows that it isn't a good thing, you know. So... if you focus in on this part of dying, the part that trusts, that accepts, that believes that our consciousness endures, because consciousness is deathless, you
Right.
know. This whole thing is going to continue on without, even if we are not here with this body, you know.
Yeah.
And so that is what we need to focus on if you're afraid of dying. Buy up a lot of these books
Yeah.
and read them, because they teach us a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I've always been kind of partial to the work of Ian Stevenson, who researched cases of reincarnation. And there's very compelling evidence with that and with the works of Moody and Elizabeth Kubler-Ross that there's more than just this, that we do at least something, consciousness. And I don't know if it's individual consciousness or if we enter into a grander consciousness, but it seems like something persists.
Yes. And you know, if you only live with your day-to-day consciousness and don't remember, for example, that we spend a large chunk of our time sleeping and dreaming,
Yeah.
you know, that's a different dimension and as mysterious as death, you know. And a lot of philosophers call sleep death. I mean,
Right.
There, you just have to open your mind up to possibility. If you close your mind up, then you know, you don't allow new things to come in, and you don't allow yourself to benefit by all the possibilities that exist in this absolutely mysterious world that we know nothing at all about. We think we know a lot, you know. We think we know a lot, but this is how much we know.
Yes, that is very, very true. And that's also one of the values of Socrates is that the only thing I know is that I do not know.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And that's what is wise. To admit you don't know is makes you wise, because it makes you open, it makes you see other possibilities.
Well, I love the message that you have in the book and in this conversation of there's a connection of living well and dying well.
Yes, and they're connected. For example, when I was ailing and unwell, I would just lie down on the bed and I would rehearse my death, you know, which is okay, rehearse letting go of who I think I am, my story in this life, or, you know, letting go this ego identity that confines me, that limits me to just this particular existence. So I think that one can practice dying. I do that, you know, and I think it's helped me. I think, well, I don't know, maybe towards the end when I'm dying, I'm going to freak out and go like soundtrack, oh, dying, you know. But I feel that all the work I'm doing is to let go easily. You know, to just slip out of my body and let go and go wherever it is I'm being taken.
Yeah, it reminds me of the mythologist Joseph Campbell. What he wanted was to have a conscious death. He wanted to
Yes.
be present and aware at the time of death.
And Huxley, who took
Yes.
drugs when he was dying,
Right, he
you
took
know,
LSD,
he took LSD because he wanted to enhance his experience of dying. That's how I would like to go, not with drugs necessarily, but I'd like to have my dying be an intense and, I want to use the word, pleasurable experience, you know? You know?
Well, maybe it will be. There's something I learned in terms of, this is part of Greek thought, is the idea that those of us who understand our suffering and do the self-examination and that we do the hard work, that that can lead us towards a gentle death.
Yes. And that's my hope too.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. 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 It's a mystery. And I think there's value in embracing the mystery.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, Kamala. I know that we are at the end, so let me ask you the questions that I always ask at the end of interviews. You've mentioned that you are working on another book on Guru Nanak. What else have you got going on?
Well, I've finished a book which is a sequel to The Pilgrimage of Aging.
Okay.
Because that book ends with the pandemic.
Right.
And the next volume is, which I've completed, is Aging in the Pandemic. You know, so that's complete. Okay. And I've got, I always have, like, I'm working on like 5 or 6 different looms. When I get bored with the one, I go to the other.
Yeah.
But lately I've been a little less engaged with writing. I've been more engaged with taking care of myself and seeing myself through my illnesses. And but if I weren't writing on a frequent basis and seeing the progress in the books that I am working on, I think I'd be a very unhappy camper.
Yeah.
So I do that. I keep that up. And it's a part of my daily existence, even if it's only for 15, 20 minutes.
Yeah.
I do continue with that.
Okay. Do you have a website or social media where people can go to find out more about you and your work?
Yes, I'm on Instagram. Okay. I'm on Facebook. You can search me under my full name, Kamala K. Kapoor.
Okay.
And I'm on YouTube. And my website is my full name, which is Kamala K. Kapoor. And it's KamalaKKapoor.com.
Okay. All right. I will put the link for your website and your book in the show notes in the video description so that people can more easily find you and find the book. Again, I thoroughly enjoyed reading the book. I thought it was beautifully written, and I had this sense, this very real sense of kind of who you were or who you are. And I appreciated it very much. And I appreciated the messages and the guidance, because I think this is for the sooner people get this message to be kind to themselves and to reflect, the better they will be as they enter age.
Yes. Yes. And we have the time to do it too.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
And it's a very good use of our time.
Right.
And I always encourage people to journal and right. not consider the grammar or, you know, sentence structure, just to write out what is happening.
Yeah.
And it's a well of discovery, writing is.
Yeah.
It takes you to places just thinking doesn't.
Right. Yeah. I have a niece who's 18, and she lives in the same house with me now. And we were talking about journaling, and she said, "Well, I don't do that because I'm afraid I'm going to do it wrong." And I'm like, there's no wrong way of doing it. Just journal, get it all out. Let it be your soul. Get your soul into the pages.
Yes. Even if you're writing in fragments and,
you know,
it doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter.
Yeah. 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 I'll share this with you. I know we're at the end, but when I teach philosophy and religious studies. And one of the things, when we look at the existentialists, there's this idea of living authentically.
Yes.
And I always explain to students that, and also choice, you know, that we choose our lives. And there's a connection between author and authenticity, the same root. And the philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre has a statement, you know, "I await myself in the future." And so what I tell students, I encourage them to journal, and I say, I like to imagine myself as a very old man, and I've got all of my journals in front of me. And I always ask this question of myself: what is it that I want to read?
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. So, Kamala, thank you so much for your time. It was a delightful conversation. And one last time, I was very fond of the book. I think it's an incredible work.
Thank you so much, Nick, for having me. It's wonderful to talk to people who've read the book because then the conversation's more authentic.
I always make a point of reading the books. I don't know why anyone wouldn't, to be honest.
Exactly. Yeah.
So, all right. Well, thank you again.
Thank you so much, Nick.
And that's a wrap on episode 160 of Rebel Spirit Radio. Thank you so much for listening or watching if you're part of my YouTube audience. Now you know what's coming up next. All the usual. Sign up for my Patreon, share this with friends and family, and share it on social media too, please. And subscribe or follow the podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. You know the drill. But here's the thing. All of that is really important. Right now, putting together this podcast is a labor of love, and I do love it. I'm in the process of making changes to improve the podcast and the YouTube channel, but it's slow going. But your support will help me speed up the process and ensure that I can continue with the podcast and offer much more content than what I provide now. As I always like to say, I'm here in the Front Range now doing missionary work in regards to religion, spirituality, and ecology, consciousness, and psychedelics, and how all of this can help us heal humanity's relationship with the sacred earth. So if you feel moved by the Rebel Spirit, and you know, I sure hope that you do, then please, by all means, help me in my efforts to share the good news. I'm Nick Mather, and you've been listening to or watching Rebel Spirit Radio. Until next time, may you be at peace, may you flourish in all possible ways, and may you continue to nurture your rebel spirit.